deep retrospective pause, and they would eventually come to the realization that this is not in their interest. So how do you do that? I think the ambassador and some others on the panel have already made these points. A much more robust submarine capability. Taiwan right now has one submarine that was built during World War II. That is not going to stop China. So they need submarines. They need somewhere between, I've seen different estimates. I've seen as many as 20. I've seen on the low number 6 to 8. They really need as many as they can. They need much more robust missile defense systems, more PAC-3, maybe THAAD. Maybe David could talk about this a little bit. I don't know if that's possible, but let's be honest. The Chinese, at least according to news reports, already have the blueprints for it. So that might not be that much of a risk for the United States. Taiwan needs a much more robust air force, just as the ambassador had mentioned. And I'm not talking about old 1980s F-16 fighters that have been upgraded. They need much more robust capabilities. So where this all leads is we need to make sure that Taiwan has the capability to defend itself and basically is like a giant porcupine, something that somebody from the U.S. Naval War College had crafted. So if the dragon ever reaches out, so to speak, to grab Taiwan, they're going to feel the pain. And I think from there, that creates a lot of policy options for Taiwan to get the international space it needs.
And here, when we talk about how the U.S. can help Taiwan with Taiwan's expanding its international space. This conference, we're very focused on Trump, but the U.S. Congress plays such an important role here. I mean, just last year, the U.S. Congress passed action. A lot of these actions are unanimously in support of Taiwan for the U.S., basically Congress instructing the executive branch, State Department, White House, to then help Taiwan play a role in Interpol and other international organizations. And in addition to this, you know, this international space issue, Congress is very helpful in reaffirming the six assurances. It's also very important in the Foreign Relations Authorization Act in 2017, instructing the executive to have high-level military exchanges, as Ambassador Young mentioned during his opening remarks. So this is also a very useful mechanism, because if the executive branch has any hesitations, it's a hand-tying mechanism to say, hey, within our liberal democracy, within checks and balances, the Congress has instructed to do this. It's good for Taiwan. It's good for the U.S. It's what the U.S. wants to do. Now it has, like, it's a hand-tying mechanism to say, we have to do it because Congress asked us to. And I think that makes it more understanding all around.
I think this is a good way to sort of move into the discussion on this sort of the military balance, and because, you know, Ambassador Young has raised this in his closing remarks about the importance of the military balance and the need to strengthen Taiwan's defense capabilities, and Harry, you know, followed on that and impressing the need. And I guess really let's talk about defense and really start to talk about, perhaps there's been discussion about, you know, sort of the need to move back to a more normalized sort of arms sales process to Taiwan, and that perhaps that, you know, given the sort of current process of notification, there's never seems to be a good time to really notify arms sales to Taiwan. And I guess maybe just to get your sort of your comments on, you know, what ways can the United States really be in a better positions to provide, you know, defense articles and services to Taiwan, and what else that, you know, you might recommendations that you might have to be able to enhance Taiwan's defense capabilities. I know you've mentioned the sort of the specific platforms and sort of capabilities that are needed, and maybe just broaden that out also as well.
Well, I know my colleagues will have things to add to this, but it's probably not a surprise to most of you that the United States' approach to Taiwan's military is not to allow them the capability to defeat China, but to buy time for what would presumably be the American effort to bring our forces to bear in blocking China. So air defense and the kind of the submarines, I think, would be a good one, although again it's hard to help a place building diesel submarines when we haven't been building them for decades. Taiwan doesn't need to defeat China. It needs to extract a sufficient price that deterrence of Chinese aggression will come into play, and also to buy time, because the U.S., through our 7th Fleet and our Pacific Command, has, I can assure you from my time in government, very specific blueprints for what we would do if Taiwan was ever attacked.
I think it was Harry and certainly the ambassador were talking about rethinking Taiwan's defense strategy because, yes, F-16s are not, you know, that take off from long runways that can be destroyed in the first minutes of conflict. You know, it's just not going to do it. So there needs to be a total rethinking of what this is. And whether it's the porcupine strategy or something else, the way I would approach this would be to say to Taiwan, tell us what you want and we will facilitate that. Because this is, you know, after all, it is not our country, and it's not our defense. The thing that I'd be worried about if I were in Taiwan, and you talk about the response of the U.S., the Chinese don't really think we have the will to oppose them. They seized Scarborough Shoal in early 2012, and the United States didn't do anything, even though the Philippines was a treaty ally of the United States. And that was, I think, a disgraceful episode in American diplomacy. And it showed the Chinese, essentially, that the United States was not going to oppose them. And what we did by doing nothing was embolden the worst aspects of the Chinese political system because we showed everybody else that aggression worked. So we have a long way on the part of the United States to disabuse Beijing of that notion. And I think one of the ways that we can do that is to work in a much more robust manner with Taiwan, because then the Chinese will see, ah, yes, the Americans have changed their view of things. They are no longer afraid of us. They are willing to use their military might. And once you do those things, I think you have certain beneficial effects, because then China is going to adjust its behavior. Every time the U.S. has shown a lack of will, the Chinese have become much more aggressive. I mean, this is just diplomacy 101. And I think this is something the United States has forgotten as we've tried to engage Beijing and bring them into the international system. This policy just hasn't worked, and we've seen this now over the last half decade. So we've got to adjust, and, you know, there are any number of different ways to do it, Russell, but I think the one way which really would have some resonance in Beijing is a full military relationship.
And just to be clear, though, I want to, Harry, I'll let you give you a chance there. Is that Gordon? Are you suggesting that the United States abandon the sort of the strategy of strategic ambiguity, and that there needs to be greater clarity in U.S. Yeah. Support and defense of Taiwan?
Absolutely. I can understand why there were certain periods where a concept of ambiguity might work. But when you have a nation which is intent and talks all the time about taking the territory and the seas of others by force, then this is no time for nuance anymore. We've already passed that period. So we need to be extremely clear to the Chinese that any act of aggression will be met with overwhelming force by the United States.
You know, Gordon, I think, makes an excellent point talking about the will of the United States or China questioning the will. You know, would we come across the ocean all those thousands of miles to support Taiwan in some sort of cross-strait crisis? But I think we also need to talk about the means of the ability of the United States to do that. And to have that discussion, we have to look at two things. First of all, we have to look at the atrophying of U.S. military power. And that's in multiple different domains. We can look at the shrinking of our Navy. We can look at the readiness of our Marines, of our Army, of our Air Force. All of these things have atrophied, whether we talk about investments because we're fighting, you know, major wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and doing counterinsurgency operations, or just the expense of it. I mean, look how expensive it is to bring about something like the F-35. So you have that one set of problems. But then you also have to take a look at the building up of the Chinese military over the last 20 years. They've looked at the Taiwan Strait crisis of 1995 and 1996 every possible way. And the one thing that they've come out of that is that they have developed a very robust anti-access area denial capability to make sure that the United States, if the U.S. was ever deploying aircraft carrier battle groups into the Asia Pacific along their coasts, that they would make the U.S. pay a price. Obviously, there's a lot of talk in the media about carrier killer missiles, different variations of that. But the Chinese have also developed a lot of other, you know, less talked about capabilities that would make the United States pay a price. Whether we talk about cruise missiles, whether we talk about having the most mines on the planet, something like 80,000 mines. Some of those are very old, but some of those are obviously very robust. Cyber capabilities, drones, all of these things would slow U.S. carrier battle groups coming into the Asia Pacific to help Taiwan in a crisis. But the more fundamental question is, could we even do that? That's where we are here, folks, with in terms of our military readiness. Yes, we spend, you know, $600 billion, 3.5% of US GDP on, you know, our military. But when you deploy that military globally, when you're off in Libya, when you're in Iraq, when you're Afghanistan, when you're trying to deter the Russians, I mean, think about all the things we're trying to do. China only has to worry about Asia. Think about that for a second. That's important.
Follow up on Gordon's point, especially about the U.S. Military relationship with growing military relationship with Taiwan. He's not alone. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John former U.S.
I feel better.
John Bolton said, "Look at U.S. interests in the region. Look at the strategic military situation. The U.S. has an interest in ensuring freedom of navigation ops throughout the region. The U.S. has an interest in deterring military adventurism and preventing unilateral territorial annexation. Therefore, John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to UN, said that the U.S. should station U.S. military troops and military equipment in Taiwan. So this is something that people are really talking about at a serious level. And to get to Russell's earlier question about U.S. arms sales and U.S. security support for Taiwan, we see that basically the U.S. because Taiwan has been an unconditional partner and former U.S. Taiwan were mutual defense treaty allies, therefore the U.S. is going to continue U.S. military support for Taiwan. And the question is whether or not this is just going to be public or if it's going to be more quiet, if it's going to be through major U.S. companies like commercial off the shelf for a cost savings for Taiwan, or if Taiwan's going to do it indigenously, or if it's going to be now or later. The U.S. held off on selling F-16s to Taiwan in the 1980s. Then Taiwan pushed to develop its own indigenous fighter aircraft. And in the 1990s, the Bush administration then sold 150 F-16s to Taiwan. So this is some lesson from history.
To put this in context for just a second, in Beijing, I think that you see the Chinese military becoming so much more influential in policymaking circles. And there are a number of reasons for it. I think most of them relate to the transition from Hu Jintao to Xi Jinping. But whatever the reason is, and there's a lot of discussion about that, the point is you have flag officers who are now making policy with little and sometimes no oversight by civilians. And when you think about the military's mindset right now, they've been getting double-digit increases in their budget, 10.1%, for instance, in 2015. But last year, they only got 7.6%. And the reason is the Chinese economy is slowing very fast. And I think if you're an admiral or a general in China, you may be starting to see a closing window of opportunity because of all of the severe problems internally in China. And that means if you want to accomplish historic goals, so for instance, like absorbing Taiwan, you may think that this is now the time to do it, especially with the U.S. in disarray. So putting all that together, we could be entering a time which is much more dangerous than we think because of Chinese assertion, Chinese desperation, Chinese arrogance, and really a indecisive response on the part of the American political system to what is obviously a surprising events that could occur.
And I just want to follow this line a little bit in terms of my next question, and that is, and this refers back to actually our first public seminar series that we had back in late September on the Taiwan Policy Review, and that was where we had speakers such as Richard Bush and David Keegan, who spoke on, and also Walter Lohmann, but the specific question on is how to conduct relations with Taiwan, and they made the recommendation, I'm paraphrasing here, that conducting relations with Taiwan should be done more discreetly. But it seems like what we're, with the sort of the positions that are being taken here right now is that we need to be more bold, that we need to be more assertive in that relationship. Can you assess the sort of the value of, sort of these two different, these sort of opinions? I know, Gordon, you've spoken to this, and if you'd like to elaborate a little bit more on why it's not good to be, sort of discreet, or, maybe other panelists wanted to sort of see how to conduct relations with Taiwan might be done in a more effective manner.
I'm one of the people who's been part of the discrete aspect of this, and I think it has a lot to be said for it. As I say, I regularly would go through PACOM, the Pacific Command in Hawaii, and those guys are on it. And so are people in the Pentagon. And President Trump has a tremendous set of assets that he can draw on, and one hopes and presumes that he's getting briefed in on all of them. That's not me, is it? Damn it.
It's PACOM calling.
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'll get back to them. All I can say, having been in the inside of this for much of my career in diplomacy, there are things that are better done quietly, and whether it's Taiwan or Japan or Korea, I think that we have been pursuing those avenues well, and the new president, the new Secretary of State, the new Secretary of Defense hopefully are getting briefed up on all of that so that they can realize how many assets they have at their disposal.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with being discreet about certain things. And also, I would love for us to do what the Chinese do to us, and that is those salami tactics of sort of making very little steps that they can't complain about. And when you view it in the entire context, you have major changes. What I'm concerned about is whatever we do, I want to see the effect on the Chinese views towards Taiwan and us. And if we can do this without ruffling feathers, sure, that's fine. All I'm concerned about is that our policy approaches with regard to China, which have been in place more or less, you know, this century, certainly since going back to 1972, they just have not been working recently, haven't been working for us, and haven't been working for countries in the region. So we do need a fresh approach. We do need to rethink things, and we got to see what does work. And if the more discrete elements work, that's fine with me. But if they don't, then I think that we need to have a pivot of our own and to reassess what we're doing and the effect we're having on Beijing, because ultimately that's the most important thing.
The Trump administration, right now, we're not even at 1 month in. We're at, like, since the 10th, since January 20th.
And seems like 2 years.
Feels like forever. Gone through a national security advisor already. So the Trump administration has not yet had a chance to demonstrate its commitment, the military commitment to Taiwan yet. No data points yet on official U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. But looking back in history 20 years ago, there was nothing more clear than in 1996 when the U.S. sent task two aircraft carriers to help support Taiwan. So you see bold moves like this make it so that Taiwan gets increased international status as a signal of strong U.S. commitment to Taiwan. It's good for Taiwan's PR. However, the discreet side makes it more practical for the U.S. and Taiwan and China to all, you know, cooperate with one another. So that's my view.
I think the least controversial thing the Trump administration can probably do, and I think it will do, is to try and reinforce the status quo. And I think you can make an extremely credible argument that the status quo in Asia, you know, just to define that very broadly, a peaceful, prosperous Asia-Pacific where economic growth, where millions and perhaps billions of people have been brought out of poverty, is a good thing. That is peaceful. So I think that's sort of the foundational point of where the Trump administration will start. What I hope the Trump administration does not do is to hark back to Obama administration policies that have failed. And that's two things. One, to use tired slogans that just don't work, that sound great, like pivot, rebalance, whatever you want to call it. And second, this need to keep doing freedom of navigation operations or FONOPs. I think that's great, but it's not a strategy. I mean, let's face facts. You know, naval vessels will go through the South China Sea and declare all of these different legal mechanisms that we all love and debate and care about. But let's face it, the islands that the Chinese have built up in the South China Sea are there. They're not going away. And we need something much more robust and much more capable of a strategy if we're going to oppose things like that. So I think we need to think these things through. And whatever we do, it has to be bold, it has to be credible, and we need to keep doing it, whatever that is.
So, Harry, you're not saying no FONOPs, you're saying more freedom or something bigger than freedom of navigation?
What I'm seeing here is my own personal opinion is that the Obama administration really just, towards the end of the administration, they really hung on to FONOPS as if it's its own strategy in and of itself. And it's not. It's one action that I think was the lowest of the low things that they could do to not aggravate Beijing, and it still aggravated them anyway. But it doesn't change anything in terms of trying to push back against Beijing, because these naval vessels just end up leaving, and we all end up having debates about whether the ship went through a 12-mile exclusion zone, didn't go through a 12-mile exclusion zone, what that means, and. You know, our friends in Beijing are just laughing at us. They see us having these debates with each other, and they're meaningless. That Beijing looks at these things in a very realpolitik sort of way. They look at the balance of power. I can tell you very clearly, they do not care about FONOPS. So that's just my own take.
We could spend all day talking about military security stuff, and I noticed my former colleague, Ian Easton, is here from the Project 2049 Institute. I'm sure that he could weigh in, and we'll just be, you know, it'll be entire. We won't get, you know, we won't hear the end of it. But I do want to shift gear quickly, and I want to talk about economics, though, and because, you know, the TPP was a critical element of the second half of the second administration, the Obama administration, and now you know that channel is at the very least permanently put on hold, and it's unlikely to be resurrected in under the Trump administration, but you know the economic relationship, as I've also indicated in the beginning, is a robust one, and trade relations with Taiwan is important. And so with the TPP gone, though, and there are talks now about the need to consider that the U.S. may want to consider negotiating an FTA or even a bilateral investment agreement with Taiwan. What are your thoughts on that? What are your comments on the economic side of the relationship with Taiwan? How to enhance that?
Well, Harry talked about Peter Navarro. And Navarro's conception of all of this is you get rid of the large trade agreements, which was the TPP, and you start to negotiate the bilaterals. So, yeah, if Taiwan wants a free trade agreement with us, that's terrific. A bilateral investment treaty, that's even better. These are things that are for us to do. I don't see any real impediment to do it except for what Beijing thinks. But you got to remember, you know, we see China as this large trading powerhouse. But in 2015, their two-way trade fell 8.0%. Last year, their exports fell 7.7%, imports down 5.5%. China is delinking from the world, and we need to trade with people. So why don't we trade with Taiwan? You know, free democratic state. I don't see the objections.
We do a lot with trade, and we have mechanisms like the annual bilateral talks, I'm forgetting what the acronym is for it, that TIFA, right, that bring people across both ways. I think our economic relations with Taiwan continue to be very strong, and they punch way above their weight, which is good for us. We have the American Chamber out there to keep us honest, but I think that the relationship has a very strong trade component to it.